Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby, and joining me is Claire White.
Hey.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. We're here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and stories. Today, we're talking about Kubo and the Two Strings. It's a stop-motion animated full feature film, came out on August 19th of this year, 2016. It's about a young boy, kind of has magical powers. He definitely has magical powers. Him and his mom are on the run and hiding from the mother's father and the boy's grandfather, who's an evil kind of moon deity.
And it's set in medieval Japan.
Set in medieval Japan, yes. Claire will be telling us a little bit about history of the film. What is it? Are you going to go into Japan,
like,
Shintoism?
History of Japan a little bit. I'll explain.
And I'll be talking about the stop-motion animation and Laika Studios and kind of what they're doing with stop-motion animation and how they're kind of pushing the boundaries with it and why it's very cool, because it is really cool.
Very cool.
Yeah, I love it. All right, Clara, why don't you take it away?
Well, the really cool thing about this movie is that it's an original story. So when I started research for this, I couldn't find a story to like, oh, this is what it's based on. But what it does is it incorporates a lot of parts of Japanese culture and Japanese story. So there's so many things that it pulls from. And instead of kind of picking one or two things to focus on, I thought what I would do is talk about Japanese religion and about the Japanese mythology of how Japan was formed and some of its main gods, because this film is so steeped in Japanese culture.
Yeah, the religion is definitely featured. So, I mean, I don't know anything about Japanese religion, but it's the there's a lot of spirituality and spiritual
kinds of things. Yeah, and the studio said they immersed themselves in the Japanese aesthetic to make this movie. So I thought by what someone who has seen this movie or who will see this movie might gain most from this podcast is learning about Japan.
Yeah, yeah.
So here we go. That was my long introduction to it. So Shinto is the indigenous religion to Japan, and it's still practiced today by many Japanese. It's actually, it is pretty much only in Japan. It's kind of like if the Greeks still worshipped the Greek gods and goddesses.
Oh, yeah, like
that. That's how long it's been around.
Pantheon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool.
And you can't really separate Japanese culture from Shinto. It's so a part of it, as like Greek culture would have been if the Greek gods were still believed in.
Yeah.
So Shinto is the worship of kami. And in Japan, they believe that all things are invested in kami. You might be thinking, what is Kami?
Kami is from Dragon Ball Z. He's green and he has antennas. And eventually he fuses with Piccolo to make Piccolo more powerful.
So in English...
Just ignore that, I guess.
We would simplify Kami to spirits. But it's so much more than that. It can be beans. It can be a quality that a bean possesses. And it's in everything, though you might not necessarily see it in everything. Only some things are strong enough or important enough to have a lot of kami and that you notice it.
So like a natural wonder, like maybe the Grand Canyon.
Has a lot of kami,
but
that rock besides the Grand Canyon has kami, but you wouldn't know.
Noted. Okay, you wouldn't feel.
You wouldn't feel.
Yeah.
And kami underpins every aspect of Japanese culture and life. Basically when humans die, you become kami. And then your family honors your kami afterwards.
How do you become? Do you know how you become kami? Is it like a statue sort of thing? I'm thinking of Mulan, which is Chinese.
No, that's Chinese.
Disney movie.
Yeah.
The ancestor worship. I guess that's very different.
It's like your spirit becomes.
Okay. Yeah.
This thing that will help the family and continue.
Okay. Yeah.
And in the way that the Japanese celebrate the changing of the seasons, they're very attuned to, like, nature and the presence of it.
Yeah.
That's kami. So to get back to Shinto, which is, again, the worship of kami, but Shinto views humans as fundamentally good, but evil is caused by devilish kami. And the purpose of Shinto rituals is to keep away these devilish spirits.
Okay.
So it teaches people that they should cleanse themselves for their own peace, not because sinning is necessarily bad, but for you.
For you, you would feel better if you did this.
If you were good, you would be better.
You're not going to get punished necessarily.
Yeah, but if you do hold a strong enough grudge when you die, you can come back as evil kami.
And that's
you're like stuck here because you we're so angry.
Yeah.
So that's Shinto very briefly.
Yeah.
Very, you know, skimming the surface. And I'm going to quickly skim the surface of Buddhism because that's it works in sync with with Shinto in Japan, because it's not like Christianity where the Christians came and were like, it's this or nothing else. The Buddhists came and they kind of incorporated their belief with the Shinto belief. Yeah. And Shinto kind of deals with the now, and Buddhism kind of deals with the after.
Okay.
So Buddhism was introduced in the 6th century via China, via Korea.
Okay, yeah. China hit Korea with Buddhism, and then Korea
hit Japan.
Okay.
Exactly. And Buddhism is concerned with the soul and the afterlife. So Buddhists believe that there's no inherent meaning attached to life, but all human beings and animals wish for happiness and not to suffer, and that the world is interconnected and all our actions have consequences, and that's karma.
Okay.
And the consequences of your actions in this life and your previous lives will be felt in your next life. So reincarnation.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're basically trying to educate yourself enough that you can escape the cycle of reincarnation and enter nirvana.
Yeah, and achieve it. Because that's the whole point, is to get out of reincarnation. That's the same thing with Hinduism as well.
Yeah. And I think, doesn't Buddhism kind of derive from Hinduism?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's, again, really brief Buddhism fundamentals. I know there's so much more to
Claire,
it.
Claire, you're like a theologian.
In my dreams. So, and I'm going to briefly tell the story of how Japan was created according to the myths and legends. So, in the beginning, there was darkness. And then the first gods were born. And they were two siblings. And they were called Izanagi no Mikoto, and that was the boy. And Izanami no Mikoto, and that was the girl. And they came down from heaven, and they created the first land by stirring the ocean with a spear. Okay. And then they built a house, and as first god siblings do, they got married and they had babies.
Nice white picket fence in there somewhere, maybe.
Probably not. Maybe like a nice shrine.
Good school system in that area.
Yeah, there's only the kids they had. So the first baby didn't work out. It turned out into a malformed fishing god. And then they tried again, and the next 8 babies were the 8 Japanese islands.
Okay.
Izanami, the girl, died giving birth to the god of fire, Kagutsachi, and was sent to the underworld. Also, quick insert, this is the part of the podcast where you get to hear me mispronounce every Japanese name.
I think you're doing a good job.
Thanks,
Claire.
Kyle. Also, I want to say that there are many versions of these myths. There's little details that are different everywhere you look at it. Yeah. So this is the version that I liked best, basically. So Izanagi died, and she went to the underworld, and her husband missed her. Izanami missed her, and so he went down to get her, and she agreed to come back up with him, but he couldn't look at her until they reached the opening. They couldn't until they got back to out of the underworld.
Yeah, out of the underworld.
But of course he did. And when he looked at her, she was a malformed corpse. And he was so disgusted that he panicked and ran away and rolled a boulder in front of the entrance so to escape her wrath. Because, of course, she was really angry that he looked and didn't want to be with her.
Yeah.
So after leaving the underworld, Izanagi shredded his clothing and he became a god. He also washed in his face in a stream to purify himself. Shinto, purifying yourself.
Gotcha.
And from his left eye came Amaterasu Umikomi, who is the sun goddess, ruler of heaven, mother of all creation. She's considered pretty much the most important goddess in Japan. The right eye came Tsunami no Mikoto, who is the moon god in charge of the moon and night. And from his nose came Susanoo no Mikoto, who is the god of the storms and the ruler of the seas. Now, they all have different stories and
rich backstories, yeah.
Different. Yeah, but I'm going to concentrate on Tsunami, who, funny enough, has the least of the stories, but that's because the movie Kubo deals with the moon king, moon god.
Mostly.
So Tsunami got bored of the perpetual darkness, and he married his sister, Atsumaru, to be in the sun. And it went well for a really long time. But what happened, this is how to make a marriage bad for everyone, is that he went to a banquet in Amatsuo's honor, which she couldn't go to, and it was hosted by Yukimoki, the goddess of food. Now, Yukimote provided this food by spitting out the fish from the sea. So she actually came out of her mouth. And then she spit out wild game from the forest. And then she coughed up rice from the fields. Now, Tsunomi, the moon god who was at this banquet, was so upset by how she made the feast. It disgusted him, even though every story of this that I read said the food was good.
Yeah, but, you know, she coughed it up. I'd be a little like,
Would you kill
maybe.
Her?
Maybe. No, I'd probably just get some Mickey D's on the way home or something.
Well, he killed her.
That's rough.
And Amaterasu was so upset that she vowed to never look at him again. And so she ran away whenever she saw him, which is why day and night are always separate.
Aww.
Now, besides that, Tsunami doesn't appear in a lot of other stories. But I read that it's because... The power of the moon was never something that needed to be instilled in the Japanese. Since the early era of Japan, they were very aware of it because they followed the lunar calendar. So all the big events in normal Japanese people's lives depended on the moon.
Yeah, the Hebrew calendar is also lunar. And that makes sense because they're, you know, the predominantly Japanese society back then, it was a fishing society. So following the lunar calendar and following the tides made
tides.
A lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's my brief introduction to Japan and the religion and how Japan was made.
Yeah, I love anime. I shamefully don't know a lot about Japanese myths or...
Yeah, think of how much I just enriched your life.
You enriched my life, Claire. Thank you.
You're
for
welcome,
that
Kyle.
Free enrichment. Get it here, DSRA.
Well, speaking of free enrichment... I want to hear all about how Kubo is made.
I will tell you something very enriching, and I want you to know that the making of Kubo and the Two Strings is fascinating and involves a lot of playing with toys.
Oh yeah?
I mean, in my eyes, for the people who actually made it, I'm sure it was work, but it looks like they're just
listening
having
to this
a
podcast
great time.
Being like that fool. He has
not
no idea.
With toys. It was very difficult. So, Kubo and the Two Strings is a completely stop-motion animated movie, which I did not know going into it, actually.
What is stop-motion?
Well, Claire, allow me to tell you.
Because I actually don't... I know what it looks like, but I don't actually know what it is.
Stop-motion animation is an animation technique that physically manipulates an object so that it appears to move on its own.
Okay, so it's not drawn. It's
technically artistry and cartooning is stop motion animation because you're drawing a picture, you're drawing another picture, you're drawing another picture. A lot of stuff can technically fall into stop motion animation, but colloquially, it's used normally when people talk about like claymation.
That's what I think of
dolls
stop motion.
Yeah,
I think of claymation.
Yeah.
I think of Wallace and Gromit.
Yeah, exactly. Wallace and Gromit is a perfect example of stop motion animation. But it, you know, it uses clay, dolls, puppets. You can really use anything. If you wanted to make a story about the potato on your counter trying to escape out your house, you could just use that using stop motion animation and a camera.
To make a movie.
Go make a movie in the kitchen about your vegetables escaping. Stop motion is one of the oldest forms of moving pictures, quote unquote, because they weren't really called movies then or you wouldn't go out to see the film. It was a wonder that you could make these pictures seem to move and come to life. So stop motion can be traced all the way back to 1898, pretty old. Yeah.
That's older than I would think.
1898. And Albert E. Smith and J. Stuart Blackton and their creation of the Humpty Dumpty Circus.
Sounds amazing.
Which is about toys that came to life. They essentially took a bunch of like clown toys and dolls and kind of performed a little circus with them using stop motion animation, taking a picture, put them in different place, take another picture over and over and over again. And we're actually really lucky where we live. We live right by a museum called the Museum of the Moving Image. It's in Astoria in Queens, and it's got a lot of information on early movies and like kind of how everything started, and just not even movies, but how people made pictures move for entertainment back in the day. I wanted to plug it. I think it's really cool.
If you come to New York,
yeah, if you're ever in a Astoria in Queens, it's a very cool museum. Now, stop motion animation, like when I would think of it, I would think of claymation, and I'm like, yeah, you know, I've seen a couple of stop motion animation stuff, Wallace and Gromit. They've been sneaking stop-motion animation into everything that you love and know as a kid. And I never really realized that it was technically defined as stop-motion animation. But Star Wars.
What's stop motion in Star Wars?
Pretty much all the effects. All those practical effects of models of the AT-AT walkers walking through down Hoth and the AT-STs on Endor, the moon of Endor. That's all stop motion animation. So it's been in Star Wars. It's been in RoboCop. Gumby, obviously, like, you know, the kind of acclamation. Right. The old Godzilla movies, the old King Kong movies. And I don't know if you ever watched Land of the Lost.
I didn't know.
It's this show about these kids kind of trapped in like a dinosaur land. It was like a fun.
Sounds amazing.
Fun kids
movie. I wish I'd been stuck there.
So yeah, it's been mostly used for like effects, practical effects and puppets and models and stuff for movies.
Nightmare Before Christmas?
Yeah, well, around the 90s is when you started seeing more stop motion feature length stuff like Nightmare Before Christmas. You also saw Wallace and Gromit was made into a very successful stop-motion animated movie. Chicken Run.
I love Chicken Run.
I loved Chicken Run as well. But once again, stop-motion, we kind of started making a bit of a comeback in the 90s. Now I kind of want to focus on Laika Studios, who are the people who created Kubo and the Two Strings, and what they're doing with stop-motion. Because, I mean, there was Nightmare Before Christmas and Wallace and Gromit, but stop-motion is something you rarely see. It's not like that in the mainstream.
No, right now. I feel like especially with Pixar, it's digital.
It's CGI, exactly. Yeah. It's computer generated models and graphics. So Laika Studios, let me go back to the beginning of Laika, which is honestly not very long ago. They were reborn from the ashes of Will Vinton Studios, and this is in Portland, Oregon, is where they're based. And they started as an animation studio, not just, they would do stop motion, but they were doing, you know, CGI and stuff. But in 2009, they decided they were going to exclusively focus on stop motion animation.
Okay. What other stuff have they done?
So the movies that came out of Laika are all, they've all been reviewed really well, and people really like them. Movies like Coraline.
Okay.
Came out in 2009, and that was with Henry Selick, who jumped on to Laika Studios from the beginning, and he's the guy who directed Nightmare Before Christmas. It wasn't Tim Burton, which I always kind of assumed it was.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
It wasn't. Paranorman, which came out in 2012, was another Laika movie. Then The Box Trolls, which was in 2014, and now Kubo. And of those four movies, like, I know they all did really well. Coraline, which is it's a movie based on a book by Neil Gaiman, one of my favorite authors I never saw. Watching Kubo definitely makes me want to go back and watch some of these other movies.
I've heard Coraline's amazing. I didn't see it either.
Yeah, they were all very well reviewed, so I'm very curious as to how they are. Anyway, Laika is really spearheading and pushing forward what people thought could be done with stop-motion animation. They're telling these really big stories with these really, really expressive characters that are dolls. You know, they're toys. I mean, in my mind, they're toys. I'm sure the people at Laika look at them.
The thesis
in a different
statement
way.
Of this podcast is
playing with toys.
Yes, by Kyle Willoughby.
But they build miniature, highly detailed sets and puppets and costumes for those puppets. Like, they have a costume department that makes tiny clothes for the tiny people who appear in their big movies.
Wow, that is like playing with dolls.
It is, and they use practical and real effects. They will use green screen stuff, but that's mostly just to remove armatures and wires and stuff that are supporting their puppets. So it's a very, very labor-intensive and excruciatingly detailed process because they're building these miniature sets and they just have to make everything look right so that when you see it in the perspective of a camera, it looks huge. It looks life-size.
Yeah, if you actually wait till the end of the Kubo and the Two Strings movie, this is in the credits, you get a little teaser of how they animated one of the puppets.
Yeah, one of the big puppets, which I'll mention later, just a little factoid about it. Now, Laika is doing something that they are the first to do in their field ever. I mean, other than really pushing the boundaries of stop-motion animation, they're using 3D printing in a way that no one ever really thought it would be used for. And in a way that it originally wasn't designed for. Now, Laika is the first animation studio in the world to use 3D printing in the creation of their characters' faces and expressions. And Laika is actually really pushing 3D printing technology further.
So they print out the characters' expressions?
Yes, sort of. They design their faces. They design their character faces in a computer and then use that computer design and a 3D printer to print out a physical copy of that face. So with Coraline, which is the first movie they did, it was the first time they used 3D printing with their movies. They made 15,000 faces with upwards of a potential of 200,000 different possible facial expressions. What they do is they'll print in two parts. The eyes will be separate from the mouth. So you can mix and match your eyes and your mouth to create different expressions of this character.
How do you keep track of that?
They actually have a team of four different, they call them facial librarians, to keep track of all the faces. Now, just for perspective, because this is the first movie they did, Coraline, with this many faces. Nightmare Before Christmas, which people thought, and it was this huge leap and bounds in stop motion technology.
One of the best movies.
Yeah. Jack Skellington, the main character, had 800 different heads.
Okay.
So Coraline, their first one, had 15,000.
Oh my goodness.
Different faces with upwards of 200,000 different possible expressions.
I also want to know, who wants the job of facial librarian?
I'd take it. People ask me at a bar, like, what do you do? I'd be like, I'm a facial librarian. They'll probably think I'm a murderer or something, though.
Serial killer. Yeah. Who's the many-faced god?
The many-faced god.
He was the first facial librarian.
Yeah, he totally was. So, yeah, 3D printing, they are killing it and really, really pushing the boundaries of what can be done. Now, the Coraline faces, which is something funny, they all had to be hand-painted. When you 3D print that face, each one had to be painted specifically colored. They couldn't 3D print in colors yet. Starting with Paranorman, though, they were able, much largely through them really pushing the technology forward, to start 3D printing in color. Because they're like, we can't have all these artists drawing freckles on every freaking face. Now, Leica is also, they're using 3D printing for mass production, which is a lot different than what 3D printing is supposed to be for. You're supposed to use it as, like, rapid prototyping, where you can kind of design a prototype of something, print it, like a prototype of a shoe, print it, see how it looks, how it feels, and then send it off to the rubber plant to be manufactured. Yeah,
okay.
Actually made. Now, while working on Paranorman and Box Trolls, they were the number one consumer of 3D printer colored resin. They were buying more 3D printer resin than anyone else.
3D resin making company.
They loved them.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, they're still pushing this 3D printing forward, and with Kubo and the Two Strings, they did the first thing. They completely 3D printed a monster for the first time ever. There's a monster in this movie that was made completely with 3D printed colored plastic, which has never been done before.
So they're pushing, really pushing boundaries.
They're really pushing boundaries with the 3D printing technology, and it's very cool. Now, Kubo and the Two Strings has actually broken a couple records. It's the longest stop-motion movie ever made at 1 hour and 41 minutes, beating out Coraline, which they also made, by 1 minute. Also, the largest, they built the largest, another different monster in it, is the largest controlled puppet ever made, stop-motion puppet, at 16 feet tall.
Ooh, it's that monster.
It's that one they show you at the end in the credits, the building of. On average, it took about a week to make 4.3 seconds of film. And the film itself took roughly 5 years to make.
I mean, good for them.
Because it's so intricately detailed and most of it is hand done. And the scene with the boat, all the scenes on that boat that you see in the movie, took about 8 months.
Whoa. I mean, it looks amazing.
It looks amazing.
Looks like it didn't take 8 months.
Yeah. Now, the director, Travis Knight, this is his directorial debut, and he's also the president and CEO of Leica. So their artists really are running the company, which is interesting. The movie cost $60 million to make. It made $12 million in its opening weekend and so far has grossed $17 million as of August 25th. Rotten Tomatoes score is 96%, so the critics really love it. Audience score, 91%, so the audience really love it. Metacritic score of 84%, so the Metacritics love it. But Claire, the real question is, did you love it?
I did really like it. I thought it was really refreshing because I said earlier it was so hard for me to research because it was a completely original story.
Which you don't see nowadays. When's the last time anyone watched a new original story that wasn't a reboot or a never-ending comic book universe?
I mean, you see them, but they tend to be more indie movie type things now.
Yeah.
But especially for like a children's story, it was so cool. And also, I liked that, I don't want to spoil it, but the mom is involved. And I feel like in so many Disney stories, like the mother is dead.
Yeah, no, it's true. In most Disney movies, one parent at least is guaranteed to get the axe.
Did you like it?
Sometimes too. I thought it was amazing. In fact, I remember I didn't know anything about this film going in. And honestly, we picked this topic because we were like, oh, we need something for next week. What are we going to do? Oh, this movie looks kind of cool. Let's go in. I'm so happy that we did.
We were talking about how badly this could have gone.
Yeah. But this movie was so freaking cool.
It was really cool. And I probably wouldn't have seen it otherwise.
Yeah. I went into the theater and I was watching it and I was like, wow, this is a cool animation style. It looks like stop motion, but I mean, it's probably not that. That would be a huge pain in the ass, wouldn't it? And then sure enough.
It was stop motion. Yeah, it was so beautiful. Like they talk about how much they derive from Japanese art, and you can just and wood cutting, and you can just see it. It's unique too.
It's extremely unique, and it's a kids movie, but it deals with good serious issues, and loss is a big theme in this movie.
I might have cried a little bit in this movie.
I almost cried. I had to In fact, I ended up staying past the credits, like watching all the credits originally because I was like, I can't walk out of this theater crying. I need to sit here and collect myself because I'm not going to walk out of a kid's movie crying. That would be sad.
How did you walk out of Toy Story 3?
Oh, I was dry-eyed, but I did appreciate Toy Story 3. That's another thing. I feel like animated movies are telling some of the best stories on screen right now, I think.
Yeah, they are doing very well. Between Pixar
and I guess now Laika is someone to look out for. I gotta go back and watch
some of the
other
films.
Yeah,
and Disney's been doing some. I mean, Pixar is Disney. I was thinking Frozen's a great movie.
Yeah, Frozen is a cool movie. But they don't always hit these really serious themes. Like, did you see Finding Dory?
Mm-mm. I've seen Finding Nemo.
You still haven't seen Finding Nemo?
No, I have seen Finding
Nemo. Oh, you've only seen... Okay.
Excuse me. Not to tattle, but our producer hasn't seen Finding Nemo.
Are you serious?
I'm so serious. I know we might not be able to work with him again.
James Foyle, you're fired. But
after this episode.
After this episode.
please keep recording us.
But Finding Dory was cute. It was fun. But it was just, it was definitely a kid's movie. This was a kid's movie that an adult could see and really, really enjoy.
I want to say, though, it's an older kid's movie. It has some scary parts. We mentioned two monsters.
Yeah.
More than two monsters in this movie.
If you're a little fraidy kid, I guess.
I was a fraidy kid. I'm not ashamed to admit it. I would have been terrified. I was a little scared as an adult.
Yeah.
I was like, and I had to remind myself, this is a kid's movie. This is a kid's movie. Nothing horrible will happen.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Claire, what did you not like about it?
We talked earlier. I mean, me and Kyle talked earlier before this podcast, but also in a lot of the research, it's very whitewashed in the
it
casting.
It is. That is the adjective that's been thrown around with it in that whitewashed casting.
Yeah, and I think especially coming out now after the whole Matt Damon leading the Chinese to defend the Great Wall of China.
For monsters or something. Yeah, I don't...
It's a very hot topic right now.
And
I mean, it stars Matthew McConaughey, Charlize Theron, Art Parkinson?
Art Parkinson, who plays, Rickon Stark.
In Game of Thrones. Rooney Mara, George Takei.
George Takei he's got a short, that's the thing, is like the few Asian people in this have very small roles.
Yeah. And I mean, nothing against the actors. They do a really good job.
Yeah, yeah.
It just is like, especially for like the boy, nothing against Art Parkinson, but like, you couldn't find a little Japanese boy, Japanese American, Japanese British boy to do this?
Yeah, to do this. No, it's true. And I know it's bad, and I know that, like, it's a little, come on, guys, well, you got to fill this Japanese theme movie full of white people. But that doesn't stop me from having really enjoyed this story.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's still a good story. And I think it's a really hot topic right now. But they started making this movie 5 years ago.
5 years ago, yeah.
I think if they were making it now, there's no way in hell they would do this.
Yeah.
Well, especially now after they've done it.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think it wasn't as much of a speaking point at the time.
Yeah.
And they were probably really excited to get Matthew McConaughey.
This is true. Yeah, that they're like, oh, Matthew McConaughey, Charlize Theron. They'll come do our movie. Clutch.
Yeah.
And it's just a funny thing. I feel like it's almost a comment on movies right now. Kubo in the movie is always telling stories, and he's unable to really finish them or wrap them up well. It's like, oh, Kubo can never finish a tale that he tells. And this movie ends, and it's a very serious movie, but in an age of reboots and never-ending comic book universes, which, like, I love, you know, we obviously love, like, we really like
that
stuff.
The reason for this podcast.
We really like the comic book movies, but it's really, really amazing to get to watch this completely original story that just exists in itself and just ends, and you feel closure at the end of it, and you.
It's almost like, can't we have both of them equally?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, maybe we're getting there.
Maybe.
If this movie does better.
I hope so, because I really liked it, and I'd really like to see Laika make a lot more movies. Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com. We would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes, because who doesn't like to rate and review the people they love on iTunes?
No one.
No one. You can find the show on Twitter at DSRA Podcast. I can be found on Twitter at Klex303. That's KLEX303.
I can be found at Along With Claire. That's CLAIRE.
And you can find our producer James at James Fowey Jr. on Twitter. That's James Fowey, FOUHEYJR. You can learn more about Kubo and the Two Strings. Well, I'll be posting a lot of really cool videos about Laika Studios and making this movie. There's a lot of cool stuff out there. And Claire?
I'll give you some more background on Japanese deities.
That sounds amazing. And you can find all that on our Facebook page. Our producer, who I guess has never seen Finding Nemo. I was going to say other terrible things about him today, but I don't think there's anything I can say that's worse about James Fowey other than he has never seen Finding Nemo. Our producer is James Fowey. Our logo was done by Patty Hyland, and I bet you, because she has such strong
morals
and such strength of character, I know she's seen Finding Nemo. She did our artwork. And our theme was composed by Pete Rowan. Yeah, I don't know about him either, actually, now I think about it. No, he must have. Anyway, once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.